This is the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I am your host, Richard James Rogers, high school science and chemistry teacher and author of the award-winning book, The Quick Guide to Classroom Management. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to today's episode on the Practical Teaching Tips Podcast. I'm Richard James Rogers, and I'm your host. And today I'm talking about child poverty and what we can do as teachers and what schools can do with holistic schemes to help these children. And if you're listening now and you're thinking, oh, this doesn't affect me, I need to stop listening to this podcast episode, I urge you to reconsider, because the numbers are quite staggering and it's highly likely that you have at least one child in one of your classes who is experiencing some kind of poverty, and probably a lot more. I mean, just listen to these statistics. In Australia, one in six children are living in poverty. In the United States, one in five children are living in poverty. In the UK, it is even worse. There are 4.2 million children, 4.2 million children in the UK living in poverty. And that equates to 9 children in a class of 30. And globally, the statistics show that poverty is by no means eliminated. 1.2 billion children worldwide are living in poverty, according to Save the Children. And what they say is that the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic has resulted in a 15% increase in household poverty around the world. So even more children today than pre-pandemic are experiencing poverty. And a lot of families were plunged into poverty when so many parents were laid off work, so many businesses shut down, never to reopen. So we've got some serious problems in the world. We've got a lot of children who don't have the bare necessities. Often they don't have pens, pencils, rulers, and all the stationery they need for school that day. The technology gap has widened. I think COVID really highlighted that. There's a lot of children who don't have basic tech tools like a laptop computer, for example, to access software and applications and online simulations and all the great things we love to bring into schools through the new buzzword known as EdTech. Now, I'm a big advocate of EdTech. But we must not forget that so many children just simply cannot access this educational technology unless we put things in place for them to allow them to do that. And I'll talk about that today. But this topic is very close to my heart. As I was a child growing up, I didn't have loads and loads of money, but I certainly wasn't in poverty like a lot of children are today. But I did have a lot of friends who were experiencing real financial problems. I come from a working class town in North Wales, full of very, very hardworking, decent people. But a lot of families were really struggling to get by. And still to this day, there's a lot of problems in the UK, as you heard from that statistic. And I would have friends who would come to school in old clothes that have been passed down from brothers and sisters, torn up shoes and trainers, didn't have the latest brand named gear, which of course becomes quite a big issue when you're a teenager, actually. The kind of brand names that children are wearing or bringing to school. And as teachers, we need to really educate children about the true value of people is not the brand names that they have, but who they are inside. And I would have friends who didn't have the basics. And I knew their families and I knew what they were going through. So, you know, I've been there. I've seen children who experience this. I've taught a lot of children over the years going through poverty. And there are some strategies that we can put in place as teachers. And there are whole school strategies that can be implemented as well. So the very first thing we must do as teachers is we must have very high expectations of these children, of all children, and especially these children who are experiencing poverty. And we must also encourage them to set their own goals, because all of the research indicates that one of the key ways to get out of poverty is through education and good education. And I look back and I think on my life as well, if I hadn't have gone to university, took out a huge student loan, which I had to do to afford it, but if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have become a teacher and I wouldn't have been able to create this podcast, which I hope you enjoy, and have a fairly decent life. I probably would have been working in one of the factories in my hometown and earning an okay wage, but you know, not living the life that I wanted to live as such. And I think that a lot of children these days, especially in really developed countries like the UK, they often don't see the value of education, particularly when there's a lot of welfare around that can help people who drop out of school. And I think it is important that we really encourage our learners to work hard, set goals, and not necessarily because they'll make more money, although that is, of course, a worthy goal in and of itself, but because they'll be doing things they enjoy, because they'll be contributing to society, and because they will be just helping others through using their talents and skills in the best ways they can. So very, very important we have high expectations. Another thing is resource sharing. Now, I must admit, when this whole clear the list thing came out on Twitter about a year or two ago, I didn't understand it at first, and I criticized a few teachers on there for asking other teachers to go on Amazon and you know, pay for their stationery and items. But actually, I've come to learn that it's actually a good scheme to help children who are experiencing poverty. If we can provide pens, pencils, spare paper, spare notebooks, spare rulers, glue sticks, scissors, whatever it is that the children need, and they're in the classroom, it removes the burden on children to have to buy these things for themselves. And I know that one of the things we try to teach children is to be organized and to bring the correct equipment to school. But unfortunately, there's a lot of schools out there and a lot of teachers out there who think it's okay to chastise children who forget to bring a pen or forget to bring a pencil or forget to bring a ruler. And you know, I've even heard of cases of children being put on detention and letters being sent home in the first instance of a child not having the right equipment. I think we've got to be a bit sympathetic with children, especially in this post-pandemic era, and sympathetic with families, because children do lose things and a lot of families are struggling. And even if you're working in a high-end, fee-paying private school, don't assume that all of the children there and all of the families there are really, really rich. I've worked at private schools now for the past 14 years at fee-paying, high-level international schools, and I can tell you there's a lot of families who are sacrificing a lot to send their children to these top schools. A lot of families who are paying the tuition fees and they don't have much left over at the end. A lot of children going to private schools who, again, don't have the latest laptops, the latest iPads, the latest tech, sometimes don't have pens and pencils. So we must remember that financial inequality and child poverty can really permeate every sector of education, even the top public and private schools. And we must be caring as teachers. I think most teachers are quite caring anyway. And having resources in class that can kind of offset the, the lack of abundance that some children might have, I think will really help. Of course, we've got to remind children, bring a pen, bring a pencil, be organized. Yes, of course, we have to still have those high expectations. But let's stop severely punishing children for not bringing things to class. Let's have spares in class which are ready for them. And I don't expect teachers to pay for them either. So if you're one of these teachers who used to do what I did, and that is purchase spare pens out of your own pocket and spare stationery for children to use, your intentions are really, really noble. But you shouldn't be doing that. You should be asking your school to fund that, or using crowdsourcing, such as the Clear the List scheme, for example. The next thing I think is choice. Unfortunately, one thing that I certainly noticed in my own teaching is that as I was doing hybrid and remote teaching during COVID, during those lockdowns, I found it quite hard to stop myself from using so much tech when the students came back to school. And I was still using a lot of the software that the children were using for independent study during lockdowns. And I think we have to remember that, again, there is a big tech divide all throughout education. And we have to provide students with a choice. When we give them assignments to do, we give them projects to do, we give them reports to write, assignments to write, any kind of output the students have to generate, I think we have to give students the choice of how they do it, and give them a menu to choose from, so that it's not as intrusive, or it doesn't expose those children who perhaps don't have the tech that others have. So we've got to stop forcing children to use Google Docs, for example, or Google Slides, or forcing children to use spreadsheets, unless it's absolutely necessary. Let's give children a choice. So oftentimes, for example, if I want children to do a creative output, I'll give them a choice of a mind map, a comic strip on paper, a stop motion animation using their phone camera, or maybe even a Google Slides presentation. But providing a menu where there's paper-based activities, and you've got the resources for those paper-based activities in your classroom as well, such as the A3 paper, the pens, the pencils, the scissors, whatever is needed, and providing also some tech options, I think is going to really help those children experiencing poverty, because they can choose the option that best fits their capabilities based on the resources they have. So that's important, choice. And I know it's tricky sometimes, especially when we're trying to develop digital skills, especially in groups as well. You know, when you have groups of children who you might have some in that group who have a lot of tech, and maybe one kid doesn't have the latest technology to access the activity that you want. In those cases, I think it's important to create a sense of sharing and caring within the classroom, and that we should share our tech resources, share laptops, share devices when it comes to doing anything tech-based. And of course, let's not forget the old ICT lab. Let's start booking these labs again. I know it's kind of old school teaching. Back when I first started teaching in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, it was all the rage to send kids to the ICT lab, and they'd go to a room that had all these computers in. And I think we must remember that sometimes that's still appropriate. because there are children that don't have the devices that others have. So maybe sending a class to the ICT lab to work on the school computers to do something is a great way to create that equality of technological opportunity. And again, I mean, that ties into a whole school system, really, doesn't it? You know, I think schools should have bookable laptops, bookable iPads, bookable ICT suites. They're still important even today, almost 20 years after the big tech boom in schools. So those are things we can do in the classroom. Also, another thing that does come up sometimes is discussing brand names and high-end items. It does come up, you know, particularly if you're a teacher who really likes fashion, you really like brand names. I'm one of those people. I really like nice things. I think it's important that we don't bring up those topics in class, you know. I have had children come to me before and ask, what brand is your shirt, what brand are your shoes, etc. And I think it's important that, you know, if you get kids asking you that, you reply by saying, well, you know, it's a brand that I like, and the brand doesn't really matter. It doesn't make you who you are. It's your personality and your character that is the measurement of a person's quality, and we mustn't forget that, okay? And I think we've got to really reiterate that message, that let's look at what's inside a person, who they are, and not the brand names that they're wearing or they're bringing to school. So that's a big issue. Now next, let's talk about whole school strategies that can help children, and whole community strategies that can help children. There's a lot of kids who don't have enough to eat, even in the UK, Australia, America, globally. There's a lot of children who just don't have enough food. And I think it's important for schools to create strategies to help them. So breakfast clubs can be really good. And I think they should be offered to all children, where kids can come into school, have a nice breakfast at a discounted price, or even get the local community involved if necessary. There was a great scheme that I saw in the UK in Blackpool very recently, where a pizza shop owner gave customers the option of purchasing a pizza for homeless people. And what would happen is this pizza shop would open from Monday to Saturday and would serve the general public. And you could walk in, buy a pizza, and you could choose to buy a pizza for a homeless person. And then every Sunday, this shop would open, and anybody could come in and eat for free. And all the pizzas had been paid for by people during the week. And what a great scheme to really build care in the community, to really create those ties and to help people as well. So as a school, if you can think about ways in which you can get local businesses involved in your breakfast club or your meals, or, you know, even if it involves some kind of PR for them or some kind of advertising for them, I'm sure a lot of local companies would be very happy to, you know, to come into school and do that and offer those discounted prices just for the media attention they would get. Because people really value that. Also, another thing to think about is campus cards. Now, I worked in a school in Chongqing, China, some years ago, and everybody had to have a campus card. Now, what on earth is a campus card? Well, it's kind of like an electronic card that the school issues. You use it to get in and out of school through the security barrier, but it's also your kind of deposit card for purchasing lunch, purchasing breakfast, purchasing anything from school. Now, if everybody in the school has to use these campus cards, it removes the need to use physical cash. And what it also means is that if as a school you have financial relief programs for children where you can top up their cards for them, you know, for those really needy children who don't have a lot of money, you know, if the school has the potential to have a campus card system or an electronic system where the, you know, the less advantaged kids, they get money put on their card by school so they can pay for their breakfasts, immediately that levels the playing field. And you don't have the issue of children paying in cash and then children paying in vouchers that have come from the local authority or something. Or children being on a list where, you know, they go to the counter at the canteen and they sign off on a list for free school meals, you know, because that really can bring a lot of stigma with it to children, especially as they get older. And it's, you know, children are not stupid and they can figure out who's getting the free school meals and who's on the list and who's using vouchers. And it can be quite embarrassing actually for, you know, for children to have to do something special because they're poor. So trying to level the playing field with kind of like a campus card system or some kind of school currency system can really work, I think. Then, of course, there's laundry schemes that I've seen happen in schools as well, where the school opens up its washing machines and things that it may have in the home economics classroom or something. And children can bring in their school uniforms to get them washed, or families can bring in their laundry and have them washed. Now, of course, you know, the issue with that is, how is it funded? How is it manned and operated? Who is it available to? So it's by no means a simple process, but it can be done. And there are schools who've made it work. And again, I think with a service like that, you've got to offer it to everyone. You know, if you've got people on a list who are coming in to do it, again, there's that embarrassment factor, there's that stigma factor. But if it's offered, and I've been thinking about this, wouldn't it be great if, in an ideal world, schools could offer a scheme where when children do PE, let's say, you know, and the PE kit is, you know, you've had a PE lesson, you've been running around the field, you've got dirty, you can give the school your PE kit and any clothes that you want them to wash, and they'll wash them for you. Now, that would be beautiful in an ideal world if we could do that, but the logistics of it, I think, would be pretty horrendous. You know, you need staff to do that. You need a system in place to make that work. So I don't think it's easy. You could potentially offer a scheme whereby families paid for it and it was a reasonable price. And this can really help families who don't have a washing machine at home and don't have access to detergents and things. So as a school, you know, it's worth thinking about these kind of schemes. And of course, there's the school library. Let's not forget the value of having a proper library at a school where books can be loaned out to children. I was a big fan of the school library when I was a teenager. And I did say before that I never really experienced poverty as a child, but I did have problems in the home. And often poverty coincides with problems at home. And in my particular case, I had little stepbrothers and stepsisters at home, well, stepbrothers at home. I had a pretty dysfunctional household for quite a while. So it wasn't feasible for me to go home and study in a quiet area. I just did not have a quiet place to study at home for quite a while when I was a teenager. So I had to go to the local library in my hometown, and it was great. I loved it there. It was quiet. I had all access to all these amazing books. Many of them went beyond the scope of the school curriculum, and it was just such a beautiful place of learning, where I could be quiet, I could be undisturbed, and I could just focus on my homework and focus on my assignments. And I think the school library can really be a sanctuary for many of these children. And I think schools should think about opening up their libraries into the evenings and weekends. It can even be a good money generator for schools. You know, if you offer the local community the option to sign up to the library, maybe pay an annual fee, and you use that money to offset children at your school who can use it for free. What a great scheme. And I think schools really need to start entering this third dimension, opening up in evenings, opening up at weekends, and thinking of ways to generate cash that can help the local community, but also help children in those schools. Now, of course, the problem with that is safeguarding, isn't it? Because, you know, who do you allow into schools on weekends and evenings if you've got children there? So, of course, that it's not easy, and I'm not pretending that it's easy, but it's something to think about. But definitely, really making sure that there's books available for children to loan. And also, I think forgiveness when children don't return those books sometimes on time. I remember once when I was, I said I was a big fan of the library. And this makes me cringe when I think about it now. And it just brings a lot of sadness to my mind. But when I was in my late teens, 18 or 19, I had very little money. And I was late in returning my library books to the local library. And I was charged £7. Now today, £7 to me is nothing. But back then, I didn't have £7. I didn't even have £7 to pay this library fine. And I just remember returning these books and the woman behind the counter just saying, "You owe us £7. When are you going to bring it? It's a lot of money, you know." And it was just so embarrassing. And I had to say, I'll bring it, don't worry. And I had to walk out, head in my hand, in shame, because I couldn't afford the £7. And I think we've really got to remember that there's children struggling, not just with their finances, but with personal organisation. And a lot of children do have dysfunctional homes these days, and they may not always be able to bring the library books back on time. So, I mean, trying to think of sanctions other than monetary sanctions for bringing a library book late, I think is a good idea. Maybe minus points, or, you know, a conversation with the head of year or something like that, I think is more appropriate. So some interesting points that I've raised there, I hope. I do empathize and sympathize with families who are going through the cost of living crisis now. You hear this phrase all over the news these days, don't you? The cost of living crisis. So many families are struggling, and we've got to do what we can to help them. We've got to be sympathetic. A lot of the teachers in the classrooms today are much, much richer than many of the children they're teaching, many of the families they're teaching. And I know we complain about pay a lot as teachers as well. But we are in quite a privileged position to do this job, and to just have a job as a teacher is a tremendous privilege, opportunity, and honor. And, you know, we mustn't forget to count our blessings and try to help where we can. And as I said, it shouldn't come out of your own pocket as a teacher. You shouldn't be expected to pay for child resources. But let's think of ways in which we can help these children. So I do hope that was, I do hope that was interesting. You know, some more things here about America. So according to Seattle PI, approximately 1 in 5 children in the United States live in poverty. Apparently that's by the American Psychological Association. A status that affects more than housing status and food supply. Children from low-income families face increased risk factors in their educational life. Poverty affects student brain development, relationships with peers, and the ability to complete a formal education. So, you know, poverty just permeates so much of a child's life. In Australia, as I mentioned, the impact of disadvantage there, 1 in 6 children in Australia living in poverty. And according to the Smith Family Research Group there, disadvantaged students are on average 2 to 3 years behind in reading and maths by the time they're 15. So that's a shocking statistic, 2 to 3 years behind. In the UK, what it says here is that work does not provide, and this is an interesting statistic, work does not provide a guaranteed route out of poverty in the UK. 71% of children growing up in poverty live in a household where at least one parent is working. So, you know, we must remember that as well. Just because a parent is working doesn't mean that there's not poverty happening in the household. So lots of somber, sobering statistics there, everybody. I personally count my lucky stars every day that I have the life I have. Yes, I worked hard for this life, but I was also lucky. And I think all of us, no matter where we are in life, we can attribute a lot of it to hard work, but some of it to luck as well. And we must not forget that there's a lot of children that we're working with who have some real problems, and we must help them. And working with the school counsellor, referring students to agencies, having a designated person in your school who can connect children with relevant agencies is pretty important. I know in the UK now, I think almost every school has a designated safeguarding lead, I think they're called. And that's the kind of person who can really put those children and those families in contact with outside agencies who can help them. But there's still a lot of schools where that's not in place, and there isn't someone who can be a school counsellor or can refer children to outside help. And I think that's got to change, because the reality now is that there's a lot of children who just don't have what they need to complete their education in school to a satisfactory standard. A lot of children not having pens and pencils, children coming to school hungry, a lot of children coming to school in clothes which have been handed down and which are ripped and torn, and you know, families can't afford to replace them. One idea that schools might want to consider, and I think this is a great scheme, is when children have grown out of their clothes, their school uniforms, the families can bring them to school and the school can wash them, launder them, iron them, and have them available in some kind of storage area in the school, pardon me, to give to children who need a new school uniform. And it can be, again, it can be open to anyone. You know, it doesn't have to be for children on a list who are identified as being poor, for example. It should be a service that's available for everyone, anyone who wants to save money. And yeah, you know, have that storage area, or maybe have a school shop where uniforms are sold at a ridiculously low price. You know, again, it can be a money generator for the school, but it can also really help those families who can't afford a new school uniform. Let's have those secondhand uniforms available and let's sell them really cheaply to families that really need them, you know? And again, I mean, I think a scheme like that where children and families are handing in old school uniforms, I think that's pretty easy to set up, actually. You need someone to organize it all. So there needs to be manpower involved, and I know that's not always easy to find, but I think with the right intentions and with collective action, I think schools can implement strategies like that, and they can be real lifesavers for families who are struggling. So anyway, I do hope that I've provided some practical advice in this episode. That's what this podcast is all about, actually, a practical teaching tips. And I do try my best to deliver those. I'm not an expert on everything. This whole topic today is something I've had to research and think about deeply before delivering this message. So if you have any expert advice, or you know anyone who's an expert in this, why not reach out and contact me? You can email me at info@richardjamesrogers.com. Once again, that's info@richardjamesrogers.com. I'll also add a poll or a question to the Spotify version of this episode, and you can type in your ideas for helping children who are experiencing poverty at school, and what teachers can do, what schools can do. And if I get enough responses, I will talk about them in the next podcast episode. And if you're looking for a good book that can help all children, whether they are experiencing poverty or not, in terms of classroom management and raising those expectations, why not check out my best-selling, award-winning book for teachers, which is called The Quick Guide to Classroom Management, 45 Secrets That All High School Teachers Need to Know. And that's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Blackwell's, Walmart, and at all good retailers. And the Amazon link to that book is in the show notes for this episode. So check that out. So thank you, everybody. Lots to think about there. Please do get back to me with your thoughts. Until next time, bye-bye for now.